Welcome to the Once Upon a Leader in Africa podcast with George Nudu. We invite you to listen to influencers and opinion shapers narrating their experiences from their leadership roles in Africa, from the world of business, community development, government, corporate, social enterprise, among others. We will glean from their good, bad, and ugly side of their leadership journey and be inspired to overcome adversity, to pursue success against all odds, to be a great leader, and many other lessons. Welcome to the podcast, and here's George Nudu.
Hello, Kaberia. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. Nice to see you, George, and happy to be here, pumped up.
Good. It's been a journey. As you know, I've been wanting to talk to you just about your leadership, even more particularly just on their flair. And I know your leadership even extends to other things. So I'm happy, privileged, and so excited that you've managed to make time to be here with me. Thank you so much.
I'm honored, man. This is wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe tell us a little bit just about yourself, Kaberia, to kick us off.
I'm this guy who was born by a union between a former Catholic nun and a guy who was unlikely to be the one marrying my mom, because I like giving this story because they're from Meru, but Meru has got different dialects, and there's a stereotype between two particular dialects, and that's where my parents come from. And so my mom was busy wanting and desiring to serve the Lord. And because of the heavy presence of Italian Catholic seminaries and convents, that is what inspired many of them at that time from that area around Meru town to serve God. So she knew she really wanted to serve God. She had a heart for service. And so her family, that's my maternal side, her family, my uncles and whoever, they inspired her to go to the Nazareth Sisters convent. Which up to today is really strong. In fact, my cousin is now the vice mother superior, the deputy mother superior. It's serious business. You know, my mom went that direction, and then she sort of made her way to study to become a teacher. So she went to Teachers Training College, and then she was posted to Narok. But she's already fully fledged with a habit, you know, fully fledged sister of the Nazareth Sisters. Meanwhile, my dad, who I really, really love and admire, was from a very, very poor background on the other side. It's an area towards Isiolo town. It's the more remote side of Meru, that is Tigania West or East, one of them. And it was backward. I mean, there was no electricity until the 90s. Roads were really non-existent, and there's a lot of grazing and livestock keeping. And it is said from a legend that the Tiganias come from a history of intermarriage with Dorobos and there's some Nilotic vibe about it. So they just look a bit different from the rest of the people. And he was not able to make it because of education, because of just the inconvenience of the nearest school, all that stuff. And you used to draw hearts on your kids, draw a heart, a village, hearts in a circle and a ditch around it. And, that's literally how my dad's village was. The grandmother's heart, the brothers, the boys' hearts, and then there's a silo over there, and then there's this hedge of sticks, and then there's a ditch. I mean, it's unbelievable. So he dropped out of school and just left and said he's going to up. He's a firstborn, so he went to up the life. He wanted to up the life of his brothers and sisters. So somehow he got this guy who helped him get him a job and got him to go to Kwale. And then after that, shortly, he went to Narok. That's why now they met with my mom. My mom really desired to serve the Lord, and I think she just felt convicted that there was life beyond the way things are being done. I mean, there's nothing, don't get me wrong, respect every denomination and what they believe in, but she felt that I think there was more out there than just being in the convent. And she decided to desert the order and got married. My dad got born again in 1971, my mom 1976. Then moved from there, lived in Nyeri. So I was born in Narok generally, and then they moved to Nyeri. So that's the product of who I am, and I've grown up loving music in a Christian home. They loved serving God in their own simple way. When I say simple, it's because my dad got a job as a storeman, that he worked in Nyeri Primary School as a storeman. Storeman means the guy who keeps supplies for the borders, gets the bread, he gets plasticine, we used to call it plasticine, nowadays they call it Play-Doh. Files, exercise books, in a little room. And then my mom was a P1 certificate teacher between class 1 and 3. And that's what they did for probably 30 years in there. But I grew up watching them and serving God and being very instrumental in beginning the congregation of the Nyeri Methodist Church. Because there's no Methodist Church in Nyeri before. So my dad was able to influence and really talk to the Methodist headquarters and who's who. And he was not clergy, so he was able to make it happen, gather a few other people, and they began. So I grew up in this Christian home as a Christian. My mom loved the Acts of the Apostles, so she inspired me to understand salvation. So when I was as young as 7 years old, I asked about what salvation is and what this testimony is, you keep giving your friends whenever they come to visit, what it's all about. And she was able to break it down for me in a very simple way about relationship with Christ vis-a-vis going to church or going to mass or whatever we were doing when we would go to Meru. And so I got born again in a rally in Kamonja Teachers College. Rally is an indoor crusade, basically. It's an indoor crusade. And, the things you see with Benny Hinn and the rest, those things used to happen. And that's how I got born again, 1983. Yeah, and then just learned to live like that. Went to Kagumo High School and then miraculously got to go to Daystar University with a little income that my dad had, but he had so much faith. Faith is a currency that you cannot compare with your regular dollar. And went to Daystar and God opened my eyes to see why I was born. Because I interacted with people from different countries, and there my heart for just singing songs for Africa and being a voice of hope for the continent, especially at that time in our generation, and so much had happened, with Zaire, with Sudan, with the uncertainties of Sierra Leone, and of course the genocide. All those things were so alive when I was in my 20s in Daystar. And that's when I started the group Sing Africa, and now I've done ministry that way, just like my dad did all those years in the Methodist Church as a volunteer layman. And me too, a lay minister in the area of music. So that's basically who I am.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. And maybe just I remember you narrating to me your love for music and what you used to do as a child. Maybe just tell us a little bit how you got introduced into music and how you just grown into it.
There's a lady who used to come and teach us piano, who used to come and teach the boarders. I grew up in Nyeri Primary School in the compound, and Nyeri Primary School was a former colonial school. And so they left a very good British legacy. And the few Britons who are there who had left, one of them was this lady called Mrs. Prickett. Mrs. Prickett is the wife to one of the senior people at the treetops who actually was involved in getting Elizabeth to know about the death of George. So I know the queen, the late queen. So I'm just a few steps. No, what do they say? 6 degree people, you know someone. I'm that guy. And so she used to come and teach us piano. I hope that this podcast, some musician will listen to it. I hope so, because I keep telling modern musicians and worship teams and worship leaders that you need to realize that there was a generation that did not have access to instruments. And that was our generation. And you would attest to that. So now you can walk in and get the keyboard. You can walk around town and find someone with a backpack carrying a guitar. That was non-existent in the 80s. And especially for me who grew up in Nyeri, far away from Nairobi. I didn't even know what Nairobi looked like, to be honest, apart from what I was seeing on TV. So when I say that I had piano lessons, it was on an upright English, British, old school piano, upright, wooden. If it falls on you, you're dead, you know? And so that's what we had. And that was really a godsend thing, because this, what are the odds of a child of some guy who keeps, you know, Play-Doh in his office, you know? And so my dad just paid for the lesson. And so we'd go and do five finger exercises. And I have to do that because Mrs. Pickett will be cross with me if I don't do the five finger exercises properly the next time we meet on Saturday. So now what do I do? So I go home and take my mom's chalk and draw the keys, especially the white part of it. The seat was gray. So then because I was an artist, I used to know how to draw. So I would make sure that I work out white, then leave it blank for the black, white, like that. And then I try and do my finger exercises. And I had a habit of playing with my fingers and hit the table and so on. So that's how I did my finger exercises. But in connection to what I'd said about my parents going to Nyeri to do ministry, before we started the Nyeri Methodist Church Fellowship, between 77, because we got to Nyeri in 1977, and 1987, for those 10 years, my dad became best of friends with the catechist of the King Ongo prison. A catechist is the guy who has been given the job by the prison service, by the government, to be a chaplain, not a chaplain, to be like the one who takes care of the chapel, community chapel that is run in the institution. That still happens if you go to the barracks and so on. So the catechist was under the Anglican, there are two, there's the Catholic and there's the Anglican. So we used to attend the Anglican because of the Protestant. And so they became best of friends. His name was Ndegwa, the late David Ndegwa. So what, because of their friendship and because of the trust that he had for my dad became a lay preacher. So we attended as one of the sort of first families of the King Ongo prisons. So what my dad tells me is that during the festivals where the King Ongo prison, let me put it in for you to understand. So it was a community chapel. Community being anybody who lives around that area are welcome into the institution, into the chapel. The chapel is in the prison compound, but the community is welcome. So you can go for mass at 8 if you're a Catholic, and then 10 o'clock or 11, you go for the Protestant one. Now, still, they would have the prisoners who are remanded attend service. A few select women prisoners would come, and they would come and sing. And then the petty thieves would come, male prisoners would also attend and also sing. But during Christmas and during Easter, the two critical celebrations, and being an Anglican chapel, then they would have the main prisoners, the guys on death row, the serious criminals who are in there, be released to come and sing and be part of the service. Now, that used to be a thing. It used to be a thing because, wow, I mean, the community is vibrant. You know, 60 men, 60, the choir was 60 people, 60 male voices, man. Woo! So they used to do that. So now they had a guy who would conduct, and he had gloves. And you know, white gloves that time were a thing. You would know. No, Michael Jackson made us do things in this world. Yeah, so he had gloves and an orchestra stick. This is 1970, between 77 and 87. That was happening. These guys would come. First of all, it's mesmerizing because when they've released those 60 men to come to the chapel, there is high security. So the wardens are around the chapel and around the compound. And how would we know that they're out? Because that's the only time we'd see them with their G3 guns. So if you get in during Easter and see one or two guys in G3, you know today the guys are out. It was such a big deal because we who are in the community chapel choir had to shift where we sit so that we leave our seats for these guys. So this guy had an orchestra stick that used to conduct and a white glove. And so when I was younger, like a 3-year-old, my dad tells me, I would then stand next to this conductor and mimic what he's doing. And so my dad thought, my dad is nice. Let me just tell you, he's a nice guy. He got an opportunity with Nyeri Primary, I don't know what they were doing, to get some things. And he went to Bomas of Kenya, traveled to Nyeri Bomas of Kenya, like a school thing. And he got me plastic shakers so that when these guys come and want to stand next to him, then I can have something practical to use. I thought, how sweet. He actually told me this story because I asked him where he got these shakers from and he told me that. So that's when I think my freedom to just be a musician came from. Before then, the piano lessons that I began when I was 9, 10. Yeah, with the story I was telling you. Anyway, yeah, every time I share this story, I just feel happy. Thank you.
No, it's really good. And that's your story. You know, that's your story. That's part of who you are. And that's what has built you up to even now when you're in Dista starting that Sing African Afleo. And just curious, just how does that spark? You had alluded to it a bit, you know, when you're in Dista, you start seeing people from various parts of Africa. Let's pick it up from there.
Yeah, and as a child, I loved African things, you know, and then I think also it's the fact that I had the privilege of watching TV and getting information. Most of the information the government was giving us was about President Moi has received this president, President Moi has gone to this capital city or whatever. And I used to really love it. I used to memorize capital cities. I used to have maps. And somehow, even in the World Atlas, I just loved the page that had the African continent, even the geography and all that stuff. I can't explain to you. And sometimes when I'm asked this question, I just say, you know, I don't know. I did not hear a voice on the wall or anything. But that is something that I think God was wiring me towards. And I would really be drawn to the social science, the dialects of the people. Like I told you, Meru has 5 dialects because I grew up knowing that since I was a kid, you know, just fascinated by the 17, 18 Luhya tribes and sub-tribes. So that was a thing. So now, I realized that along the way, I would really be fascinated when I meet someone from another country. The one or two few that we had. But then also in Nyeri Primary School, people from other places, other provinces, because we were all there, it was very cosmopolitan. So going to Daystar was like, now I'm an adult and I have seen this when I was a kid. Now it's actually happening in front of me that here is someone from Rwanda. Here is a whole bunch of 40 Ugandans, Tanzanians, you know. So when I see them and I'm thinking, wow, I can see the country on the map, but let me get to know you more. And then the fact that there were 27 nationalities that time. Now, when you exclude the United States and Korea, because we had students from there, the rest are all African countries, including Angola and Madagascar. What are the odds of having someone from Madagascar around you, you know? And so I thought, oh, here's Portuguese speaking, here's Malagasy speaking, here, all these people. I really felt that I had reached a point where now with all that I've had experienced now, I am an adult, I can be able to get deeper with these conversations. Yeah, so I think the interaction, the way Daystar taught us, and really, that's another thing about my life. I cannot talk about my life without talking about Daystar University, and even the university knows. Talk about them. And this is the reason why, because they had this thing. Honorable Pogisho, the former Minister of Communication, Information, and MP of Kacheliba. He used to be my lecturer, our lecturer for many of us of that time, on communication and culture. But the way they conducted the communication and culture class, they paired us with something called a cultural partner. I don't know what about other institutions, whether they do that. So cultural partner, yeah, we'd understand it from prayer partner. Us who are very, very CU people, we understand prayer partner. But now there's this cultural partner. Cultural partner is you're paired with somebody, and that person has to be from another context, and in this case, from another country. And I was paired with this guy from Rwanda. And to be honest, I have tried to remember his name. I'm very good with names, but I, to be honest, it's refused. And I've told the Lord, just remind me his name. So this tall guy who had just lost most of his closest people in his family from the genocide, and he was my cultural partner. So you can imagine how our assignments were. So you have a cultural partner for the semester, as long as you're doing that communication and culture, and spend time doing assignments together. And the assignments were like this, conversational. You know, what are the individual traits? Do people hug in your context? What does this mean? How do you construct? No, just very practical things. Man, I got so engrossed in that conversation with this guy every time we'd meet, and I could see his pain. And I understood the Tutsi Bahutu story and deeper. Now I'm 18, 19. That's one. And then I'm heavily involved in the ministry, of course, because now for me, I mean, I cannot just not sing. So I'll hang around the guy with the guitar and so on. The guy with the guitar is from Uganda. And the guys in the worship team, you've got people from other places. And then you know how university is, you know, peer pressure. And all of a sudden, you're in Uganda. You know, I went to Uganda when I was 19. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm out of Kenya, man, at 19. And so it became, I realized that I would get so joyed by just being out there. And up to today, if I went to Uganda, I mean, I'll just grab a Rolex on the way. Rolex is chapati that they roll on the side and roast chicken, and that, because it's a habit I picked up when I was in university. That's what Daystar did for us. So now when I connected, now I had the presence of mind to connect. My dad took a step of faith to afford. We are the generation that started going to private universities when very few people were going to private universities. You know what I mean? It's either you're doing private university or you've got the economic strength to go to parallel in Nairobi University. So I was amongst those guys and miraculously went there because my dad just took a step of faith and God provided all that time. So I was able to connect. What I'm doing here is because of my dad's faith. And so from there, it was just easy to start being creative on how to speak to the African continent. And so because I had songs that I was writing and I was growing. You see, now when you're in that discovery stage as a young person, you're now creating. I'm very enthusiastic about the music, learning new things and going out there, and I'm passionate about music and I'm passionate about people. And I know I can bully myself around to learn something. That's one thing about me. I mean, I managed in high school, even when I was being bullied as a form one, and I still sat at the piano with a form four, and I didn't care how they was chasing me out, but I needed to learn how to play this thing properly beyond what I'd learned, you know, because I'd learned classically, but I wanted to play to sound like the radio. I wanted to play rumba, and I wanted to play choruses, and I wanted to play. So I bullied myself around anywhere I would hear something. And now I had integrity music, and I want to play like them. And then I'm in this place where there are many musicians from different places. And one of the guys who gave me piano lessons was a guy called Simon Opolot, who was a Iteso guy from Uganda. I mean, this Uganda, Tanzania is around me, Rwanda is around me, Angola. And so it was sort of like God had prepared a place for people and a place where we can now sing for the continent, speak life to the continent. I had a study partner along the way called Anthony Makana, who later became one of the people in government in South Sudan when it was formed. And Anthony used to study with him. He was from South Sudan. And I think that's when it hit, the icing hit, and said, you know, when I got to see that many of them really looked up to Kenya for growth. And man, I don't know if, well, let me not get into IGAD and other things, but I think that sparked me to say, we're going to sing for Africa. We're going to speak life to South Sudan. We're going to speak life to Zaire. It was changing its name. Zaire changed its name to DR Congo in the middle of a Sing Africa concert. You know, for me, that's a thing. Yeah. And we're going to do that. We're going to speak life. My cultural partner has lost people. Rwanda's situation is a mess, but we're going to sing because we are young people. We have no much you can offer, but we have a voice to offer. So that's how it started in 1996. Got my best friend, Moniki, we started writing songs, got my guys together. And somehow God just prepared everybody there. We had Nigeria there and other countries in the choir when it began. And I'm glad to say that the students in Daystar now, 24 years later, still 24, 25 years later, are still doing Sing Africa. They have it. now at Daystar. Yeah.
Wow. And Afle was birthed out of Sing Africa?
Yeah. No, it's the same. I mean, we left. So these Daystar friendships are very strong. Our generation married each other. We were very strong because this thing really just did something to us, changed our lives. I mean, there are many stories. I won't get into that. Maybe we need to do a podcast on Sing Africa's missions specifically. Or if and I had to come and talk. But basically, it's that vibe was just so strong, and we did not know any other friendships. And you know how it is in university, you get life friends and so on. So we just continued being friends. And we knew that God had called us for something greater. Even the time was, during that window is when now I plugged into ICC heavily. But I remember Bishop Kitoto asking me, what more can you do for the church beyond leading worship, because that's what I was doing at ICC. And I remember telling him, there's something that God gave me at Daystar. I can't put a finger to it, but I know for now what I'm doing for ICC is what I think is comfortable now, because in my heart there's something bigger coming. And that thing now that was coming, which I knew was coming, was a flow. Because basically what happened, the ministry continued in Sing Africa. Just go there, find a choir, do your thing. But us now, we are no longer students, but we know there's something that God has put in our hearts. And so different stories from different people around us. We were about 8 of us. But primarily, we can say like 3 of us had different unctions of clearly that, no, I think it's time we did something that is close to what we're doing. And one of them was myself, who I got this vision of seeing people coming together to sing together and worship God together. But that also had been quickened by the fact that at International Christian Center at ICC, you remember we used to do praise festivals. So the praise festival model, of which, again, there's a Ugandan story beyond that. I went to one day, I just went to visit my friends in Uganda and attended a service at Kampala Pentecostal Church, which is now a total church. And they had a praise festival. An afternoon, where Pastor Gary Skinner was just leading everybody in praise and worship. Then I came and told our music director then, Rachel, told her, I've just come from Kampala and I'm doing this thing. And she was like, I've been looking for something to do. And that's where praise festivals began. So just a conversation between Rachel and I. And that model now grew into, I kept telling her, and Bishop Kitoto, there's something. That's when everything aligned. And I was like, I've been called to Africa. That I know. But I can't go back as a student at Daystar. And I don't think even the institution was ready to formalize anything in that way of, we didn't even know what it was. We're just going with the flow. But I think my experience of the Praise Festival and the things we did at ICC, then now we married that. And that's how come we had now the worship version of speaking life to Africa. The Sing Africa was a ministry version where you go for missions, literally go for missions, sing songs that were written. But this is now the worship version, where the body of Christ now comes together from the continent, worship God together, ideally all born again people who understand praise and worship, to lift up the name of the Lord. And that's when we say, Africa, let's worship. And the same group, which is 8 of us, we just, after seasons of everybody scattering, and then all of a sudden, miraculously, coming around a certain season, and then we meet in our house, small house in Nairobi West, and discuss up to 2 a.m. and look at each other in the room, and you're like, you can do marketing, you can do administration. Kaberia, you do the music, of course, and you can do, and we're all there. Every single gifting was there. We did not even need to think about structuring the leadership. We just had it. So funnily enough, we now worked out our first roles and offices when we were trying to get a structure into the ministry, based on the people who are seated over there. And we said, what do we do? Let's gather all these people. I had connections now. I had Voices United. I had ICC. Kama Mugambi was at Nairobi Chapel doing his thing, different recordings that we're involved in, all the albums. I was involved in them and helping with Jack Odongo. It's those things of, I know a guy, Chris Adwai, I know Jack Odongo. And all of a sudden, this is now the story of 2003. All of a sudden, by October 2003, we have an idea of some way forward of this thing. And then now beginning 2004, we are putting together an event of all these people, 180 of them who have just shown up saying, you had a rumor that there's a thing. And the choir at Praise Festival in ICC that time, 75 of them are saying, once you finish the last song today, we are coming to follow you on this thing you're talking about. And 2004, Aflo began. And we just said, let's do this. Let's have the body of Christ come and worship. ICC was already taking a lead in that that area. So the vibe was really still, there was that hunger. It was going on, and God was doing something through Pev as well, and starting Groove, and Kinan Jugushu are doing their thing. Chris Ador was already doing his thing with Voices United. So it was just, it was a time that was working perfectly. And so the first Aflo event, we just said, let's do an event. We just said, let's do an event. And bring body of Christ free of charge. Let them come and worship. It was as simple as that. Little did we know, man, it was just going to be something else. And in the middle of the night, we say, let's meet again next year. And you're thinking, did we just say that? And so the story of Aflo, really, even when people ask, we just tell them, you know, we are just guys, came together, believed that we could pick what we had birthed in Daystar and our heart for Africa, and believed that through what we were doing, change will happen in this continent.
Part one of this episode ends here. Join us in our next episode for part two.
Thank you for joining us in today's podcast. We hope you're leaving with insights that will help you live and lead better. We appreciate our sponsors, BNG Consultants Limited and BNG Center for Leadership Coaching, for keeping us on air. Bye for now. See you in our next episode.